Now, you know, Prometheus is a man in a myth. And a man in a myth is really a principle. He could be a man as well as a principle. He could even be a man with principles. And in fact, historically, the only principles that we know about have come through men who have discovered them. So when we think about Prometheus, we have to think about a man at some remote period who actually had a thought that was worth recording, and which he himself, through his work upon it, conferred upon the human race. So we have to think, if we hear about a man like Hercules or Odysseus or Achilles, we have to think that at some remote period a man did something, because without evidence, visible evidence, no human being can ever come to any intelligent conclusion. This is the meaning of the incarnation. This is the meaning of existence. Existence means to stand out from the background of infinity, and by standing out, to say something, to do something, which becomes, by this fact of standing out, obvious to the other beings who are not standing out. Now, when we consider this myth of Prometheus, we are considering something of tremendous importance, because Prometheus has occupied the minds of the leaders of the human race since this myth was first compounded. So we're going to start with a dot, and we're going to say that that dot has been posited, put there. When we say posited, we mean someone put it there. Some power spat out of infinity into finity. To posit is really to contract. To contract power onto a point. We have PO, the base of power, and we have ST, the base of to stand. Posit means power standing. To stand, it must act upon itself. If I draw a line, and that line is continuous, and we were to extend it infinitely, we would not be able to stand on it unless we had infinite feet. But if we select a portion of that line and then rub the rest of it out, we have then posited a finite out of this infinite line, which is pure being. We have selected a portion of it, and in so doing we have made power concentrate upon it. So I'm going to put a P down here for this positing function. P you pronounce with your lips explosively. It's a labial plosive. You go P. And this symbolizes the positing by power of some finite. So when we write the letter P, we are to think about power positing itself. The power posits itself. Now, if we contract this line even further, and imagine that in order to contract it, we have to concentrate. You see, we've written a letter H. We had an infinite line, and we marked it off with a unit, and we've contracted it, and now it becomes more obviously an H. Now, that H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. And if we draw an 8, we see that we've drawn a diagram or a symbol of reciprocal relationship. If we turn the 8 on its side in that way, it's a very well-known doodle done by businessmen when they're thinking about how to deceive their partners. They go, that's for me, and that's for him, and that's for me. So the doodle tends to go like this. Now, this figure of eight symbolizes reciprocal relationship. It symbolizes that if we posit something, there is a reciprocal relation between what is posited and the infinite field which has posited it. Because it is not posited by nothing whatever. It is posited by the field. So it must be in relation with that field. So the first thing we observe, that when we posit a reciprocal relationship. To say something is to cause a reverberation in infinity, and infinity responds to this reverberation. It adjusts itself to this initiated, posited vibration. So if I tap this, it responds to the tap. I posit through my finger the energy. It replies by positing against my finger, equally oppositely. We hear a noise, which is the impact. If that thing were very, very clever, and as I went to strike upon it, it withdrew at the same velocity with which I approached it, you would hear nothing. So if I can make a knock, it is striking me as hard as I'm striking it. Now this is the most important thing about the Promethean myth, that there is, in the act of positing, brought into being reciprocal relationship. You cannot put down a dot, a jot or tittle, as Christ calls it, without the Father knowing about it. Not one sparrow falls to the ground, not one Promethean gets chained to a rock without the field knowing about it. You cannot do that without shaking the moon. This is elementary physics. You cannot move a piece of dust without altering the electromagnetic situation where the dust was. And this changes the whole universe. To accept that nothing can be done without creating a reciprocal relationship, a response, is the key to living. We'll see why later when we examine that word live. Meanwhile, we've started the first letter of the name Prometheus, P for positing. Now when we posit, we cause a little vibration. The vibration is symbolized in the letter R, because you can thrill it. You make your tongue vibrate in order to say that R. So there we are. We have PR. And PR is the base of all public relations, personal relations, and pi-rational activity. We posit a power, and the power vibrates. It vibrates because it reacts. I cannot knock that thing without that thing knocking me. And as I knocked it before it knocked me, an oscillation is set up, a vibration. That vibration is the letter R. So we have now two letters of this Promethean name. And these two letters are very, very basic. If we go back into the most primitive languages, as in the word primitive, we find pr, pr, as a base in the word primitive, prime, prior, and so forth. Pr means the positing and the reactive reciprocal relation, the result of that positing. You cannot slap somebody's face without the cheek wobbling a bit and possibly damaging your finger ends if it's a hard cheek. So here we have pr, the basis of prime, of first. We turn F into P and P into F by Grimm's law. So we could quite easily write FR instead of PR, because this F is initially a P with the air stream continued through it. PR, Freer. Freer, a goddess, and free The ambition of every human being to be free comes from the same thing. To be able to posit one's own universe, like Thurber, and to vibrate that universe by that which you have posited, and by this positing to enter into reciprocal relation with this situation in which one has posited. Now, the next letter is an O, and this O, originally a serpent with tail in mouth, means any situation whatever, any circumscribed circumstance, any organization, anything whatever that is definable is an O. So when we say pro, we have said the same word, piro, out of the circus. That funny fellow who has a funny kind of mind, he thinks in a weird way, he is piro. He is a pi-rational being, he is a pro-Methian being. Pro means for, but it also means before. Because you cannot be for something unless you examine it beforehand. Now, the next part of the word is based with ma, which is a base to measure. You all know that word ma-ya, Sanskrit word for the universe of forms of play, usually mistranslated illusion, when it actually means to measure and to affirm that measurement. Here we have positing power, reciprocal vibratory relation in a situation. Then we have measurement, ma, same base in mathematics, same base in the word mind, in manas, in mentation, and so on. If we shift that to E, we then have this meth, which is math. If we'd said pro-math, we would have said before counting. Now, the use at the end of Prometheus simply means the issue thereof. So Prometheus means before counting issue. So when we're talking about this man, Prometheus in the myth, we're talking about some being who existentially was the first being to count before the fact. We must hold this in mind in order to understand what kind of relation he has with the gods, why he annoyed Zeus. When we examine Prometheus, we find he had a father, and his father's name, you can say I or J, it would be just the same. I-A-P-E-T-U-S. Ya, put, issue thereof. His name is Ya-Petus. His name is affirm, positing, fixation, issue. That is his father's name. And his father was a Titan. Now, you know Titans were the children of gods and men. They were the men that did all the great deeds in the ancient world. They were the Nephilim, the Titans, the mighty men of old, who did everything precisely because they had understood something about the blue tit and the black tit and the coal tit and all the other tits in the universe. This word tit is a word like the word tat, which is the origin of the English word that. All we've done is put an H, a power letter, into that T. Now, if we were to draw that word T, T, like that, and put a triangle on it, we would have written the word tat. Now, this word tat means that, and it was used in the ancient world to symbolize the infinite field which has posited the universe. So when they said tat, that, they oppose it to this, because the THIS implies an issue. This word, that, implies intersections of the absolute forces. The word this implies that at a point of intersection there is an issue, a serpent. That mysterious diagram is the word this. So when we say this world, we mean the world of phenomena, the world of sense stimuli, the world we see with our five sense organs, smell, taste, touch, listen to. All that is called this world because it's a world of issuance. Light hits you in the eye and gets through that cornea of yours, through your heart defense mechanism, and hits you in the retina. It has slipped in. It has come from outside the observing organism. It is therefore called this world, whereas the infinite one is called that world, because there is no issue, because that world, the eternal world, is actually not issuant. It is eternally omnipresent. It never goes anywhere, because it is already infinitely extended. It can't go anywhere, because it is already there. It is infinite. It is omnipresent. It is omnipotent. It is omniscient. That is that world. And we have opposed to it this world, the world in which we are now looking and listening, or not listening and not looking, as the case may be. Then, in the relation that and this, in eternity and time, we have the function of the Matthews, the Metheus in Prometheus. We have to evaluate the relation between this world and that world. That world is eternity, in which everything is simultaneously co-present. This world is the time world, in which things function serially, one after the other. Now, this father of Prometheus is very important because his father, father means generative power, put here. He who put us here is called put here. Put here, pater, father. Another sound shift from P to F, pater to father. Now, when we look at this word, we understand the generative power that appeared in Prometheus was a power that affirmed positing in the field of intersecting forces and the issue thereof. So his father was a generative energy seeking a method of positing within the infinite its own purpose. The infinite may have a purpose, but when this infinite gathers itself together, it posits a particular finite purpose within the infinite purpose. And it does this because it enhances the value of the infinite and the finite simultaneously in the mysterious reciprocal relation of eight. So now we say this force that was determined to affirm the positing action and the issue thereof was the father of Prometheus. And he had a mother, like most fellows. And his mother's name, if you like to pronounce it Clymene, you can. The obvious thing about it is that word men here, the same basis as mathematics again, mensuration, measurement. His mother was a closed measurer. That is, one who cut down that infinite line and made a little zone for closure. His father was the will to posit, and his mother was the will to close, to contain the situation. Sometimes it is said that his mother was named Themis. Now you'll notice that this word is simet backwards. Remember, the Greeks wrote both ways. Simet is the same base in symmetry. He is trying to balance both sides of this letter 8. He is trying to balance the infinite and the finite. Whatever God wants, God can want. We can't stop him wanting. But we want also, as finite positive beings, to do something with what God wants. God has said, this is my world, and you will do as I say. And man says, we're not quite sure whether you exist. So we'll have to do the best we can. Now, if we think about it very carefully, we'll know that God does not exist unless he incarnates in a man. Because ex-ist means out, standing. And this infinite, eternal, omnipresent does not stand out. So it's quite correct to say that God does not exist. He's not supposed to. God insists absolutely throughout infinite space. He's not an existential being, he's an insistential being. But man on earth is an existential being, he stands out. And this outstanding being is saying to this eternally instanding being, whatever your purpose is, because you are infinite, I cannot know what it is finitely. So it is for me to find out something that may or may not agree with what you want to do. And as you are omnipotent, you can interfere with my positings, if you so will. So I will assume that if I don't get stopped by you, then it is legitimate for me to do it. Now this is the great meaning of Prometheus. Prometheus says, if I do not get stopped by Zeus, by the great Father God, that word Zeus comes from a word meaning glistening ether, the infinite light. The infinity of light in eternity is Zeus. And Prometheus is the posited forecounting process within it. And it is the problem for Prometheus, how can I relate myself to this infinite intelligence, this glistening ether called Zeus? Now, if we think carefully about this, we can understand, because of the sound shift from P to F, that Prometheus stole fire. Fire and reason are the same thing. And if what you call energy, the fires of life, your fiery desires, are also your thought processes whereby you connive, whereby you plot, you plan to fulfill this desire. You cannot have a desire that is not also a reason. Every desire rationalizes itself. So that Prometheus, this forethinker, necessarily steals fire. Now, on one occasion, there was a meeting of gods and men to decide how to divide the sacrifice. You probably know from historical studies that in the ancient world there were men who went about saying they were gods. And they wore funny headdresses and they said, I am God. And they didn't do what William Blake did. They didn't say, and so are you. They just said, I am. Now, it's a matter of logic. If I say, I am God, it doesn't follow that logically you are not. But if I just say, I am God, and I don't mention you, and you think illogically, that because I've said I am God, therefore you are not. That's your rotten logic. It's not my fault. So those men who said they were gods were those men who had actually discovered the principle of the Godhead. The principle of the Godhead is nothing more or less than self-precipitation power. When you say God the Father, you're talking about God the put here. Something put us here. This power that put us here is this God. Any human being who knows that he put himself in the situation is a God. When Christ was accused of blasphemy, he replied, is it not written, ye are gods, all of you? So why do you behave as if you are not gods? The essence of a God is just a God posits his own life. He puts his own value down. He creates his own concept. And he does this by concentration of the energy that is around him in the infinitely extended field. So then we see, when the gods and men came together, they came together on one occasion to decide who would get the best part of the sacrifice. Now, it was customary in the old days for very, very smart men to say, we have to sacrifice to the gods, so we will kill 1,000 bullocks, or 1,000 rams, or 10,000 something else, 50,000 larks for their tongues, and so on. And then you put these out, and you let the gods choose, because they know. I mean, they started it. So they have first say. So it was customary to get the best part of the beast and to get the worst part of the beast and put them in two different piles. And then the gods came along and looked at them and considered very seriously those bad and those good. But they didn't rush because they had self-control. They examined the worst slightly longer than they examined the best. They knew immediately which was which in the first place. But noblesse oblige, we must consider very carefully whether we want this dirty old half-chewed bone or that lovely piece of the very nicest, juicy, over there. We mustn't rush. Because the non-gods, that is, the people that don't know that they're gods, might think to themselves, he was rather quick on that. I have been taken advantage of. And this causes a kind of horrible feeling in the non-gods. Non-gods are very funny. They don't like being deceived. Now, gods don't mind being deceived because they are the deceivers. What they say is, the number 8 also means acht. It means wake up. The word wake comes from the same base as 8. The German tells you acht, wacht. The number 8, gib acht, pay attention. Wach, auf, wake up. Christ says the same thing over and over again. You are wandering about. You are gods and you don't know it because nobody told you. But those who tell themselves, they are gods because they tell themselves. So, when we come to consider the sharing, we find at some point a smart fellow who was not a god, he was a half a god, because his father was a god and his mother was a sea nymph. It's not without significance that she was a sea nymph. It means that she had a very, very, very vague mind. Now, if you're sufficiently vague, you can find anything out. The worst thing about a wife with a vague mind is she's apt to think of anything, including some of the things you're doing, which is why some of the best clairvoyants have vague minds. So his sea nymph mother, combined with his positive type father, said, it appears that these gods rather get the better of the division when we're dividing the beasts of the sacrifice. So, as it is my duty to make the piles out, offal and rubbish over there and the best over here, I will just try a little trick. So what he did was get the very best of the meat in one pile and he covered it with offal. And then he put the skins and the other bony stuff in another pile, and on top of that he put the best quality fat. Now this is breaking a rule, because the fat should have been with the best stuff and all the rubbish should have been together. Now Zeus at this time was not quite alerted to the fact that a new emergent had occurred. So as soon as he saw this, he immediately went and he got the pile with the fat on the top and said, that's for me. And when he lifted the fat off, it was nothing but bones and skin. He had been deceived. Now, when a god gets deceived, he gets very, very annoyed. It's a divine principle. One must be annoyed if one gets deceived. Otherwise, you can't remain a god. So, Zeus got terribly annoyed with Prometheus, and he revenged himself. And he did this by either taking away the fire or withholding it, or he got hold of Prometheus and turned him to a rock. Now the story varies slightly at this point, only because there are different points of view. What we have to remember is that Prometheus means forethought, that at one time there was a man, the very first man, who thought, I have detected the God's methods of dividing the spoils and of taking always the best for themselves, so I'm going to cover up the best with the worst and see how they go on. And once this had happened, the gods were very annoyed, and every rational forethinker was now in disgrace. Rationalists like Tom Paine, men like Voltaire, they are in disgrace with the people of power who have been on the top for a long time. And when they are in disgrace, they are deprived and they are ill-treated and they are turned into dungeons or tied to rocks. And so, historically, we know that there have been men who were forethinkers, Prometheans, who have been badly treated by the men whom they deceived when they were trying to get a fair share of the world's goods. Now, that is one interpretation of the Promethean myth. And we see that hidden inside it is another one. We are going to divide now in five zones. Can you see the bottom zone? Shall I move it up? Is that bottom zone visible? It'll do. Now, we have here on our hand something to aid us. Little finger symbolizes your physical body. Ring finger, your life force. Middle finger, your desires. First finger, your intellect. Thumb, your will. Essentially, you are a power. You are will. You don't have it. You are it. You have, by means of this will, a faculty called the reason. You can empower it, which makes desire. You can enliven bodies with it, and you can make those bodies move about under that energy impulse. So we have five zones here, and we're going to look at them, and we're going to say the physical body down here is the basis of all our experience and everything we say. If we do not have first a physical body, we are not here to join in the debate. But this physical body is made of finite particles, energy quanta, which are swept together by this field. This body is posited by this field. It is posited, and this is very important, from outside the particle. That is, this particle is a product of a contracting field. Your physical body is a limitation imposed on itself by the field from outside. An infinite field of power posits itself a body. Now, having made that body, it treats that body very roughly, with volcanic eruptions and earthquakes and so on, and eventually, by very rough treatment of this body, it reduces this body to a very, very fine substance which we call protoplasm. Your protoplasm is nothing but the mineral world grind down progressively through volcanic and earthquake action, glacial action and so on, so that the body in a functioning manner, the kind of bodies we have, is evidence of tremendous forces operative which have acted and literally ground down to the most fine particles to make out of a fairly large mineral particle a very fine, subtle, reciprocal relationship, the colloid, which has such intimacy of forces inside it that it can then manifest a life body, which we will call the biofield, the life field. And this life field is there before the body, but it cannot function as a life field until the body is made. And the body is made by tremendous actions of pressures, contradictions, oppositions, earthquakes, volcanic action, and so on, till the body is made, and it is progressively refined until it is sensitive enough to respond to the biofield, which again is acting upon it from below. And when we examine protoplasm in any form, like an amoeba, a paramecium, whatever form we take, a low form, we find that protoplasm always moves towards and away from stimuli according to the nature of the stimuli. When the stimuli are gentle and undulating and rhythmical, it moves towards it, and we know by analogy that it experiences pleasure. If these energy inputs are too fast or too heavy, it experiences pain and it contracts, it moves away from this situation. So at the level of the biofield, we find a very sensitive substance, almost entirely water. It's a colloid. It is so sensitive that every slightest disturbance causes it to tend to react, and it's very, very hesitant. It hasn't yet got in it the self-mobilization. But there is always, when the stimulus comes, the appearance of desire or aversion. It moves towards the stimulus or away from it. So we now say the activity operating on the desire level here, acting onto the biofield here and onto the body, again from outside. When the stimulus comes, the desire, the movement towards or away from, manifests. So we've now got a kind of threefold being, a being with a body, with a life sensitivity in it, and desire. It reacts to a stimulus. And this threefold being has been created from outside. And this is the most important part about it. It has been created from outside. The field has organized the body. The field has refined it till it is sensitive, a life substance. The field has stimulated it till it manifests as desire. All this is conducted from outside, and this we must hold in mind. Up to this point, everything is from outside. But we know there are two other levels above here. There's the level of cosmic logos, which in man we call the intellect. And there is a level of will. But the essence of will is that it does not operate from outside. We have three levels here, operative only under external stimuli. And we have one at the top there, who is watching. Remember, the one at the top, the will, was the one that posited the body in the first place. The one that sensitized that body into a life field. The one that organized it and made a desire response in it. And now, watching it in the evolutionary process, this will says, it is now time for me to give an order inside this body by means of a peculiar process called reason. So the will up here, which is eternal and indestructible, now, with its own vibratory self-awareness, which is its logos, or reason, watches this threefold process, and as it becomes more and more refined through its experiences, because the experience is always refined more and more, and the more suffering, the more refinement, worth noting, and you can't get refined any other way. As the opposition increases, there arises in the desire field such a sensitivity that the desire field becomes aware that at the next level above it, there is logos, there is reason, there is Prometheus. So that at the top level of the desire here, there is a sensitivity which keeps flipping into the logos and out again. And it's at this point along here where the top level of desire meets the underside of pure logic that Prometheus comes into being. His father has posited in this desire, this Ya Petus, has posited in this desire field, which is the sea nymph. And now the mind begins to break into the desire field. It does it at first in the history of the world in little flashes. The refining of the life process causes sudden intuitions. Something can be seen slightly beforehand. And therefore, at this level, there is awareness that there is something from above. Now, at this point, there must be what is called prayer. Prayer means work. Work of a special kind. PR work. To pray is to affirm reason. Cosmic reason. So that at this moment, the top level of the desire is now not to react to the external stimulus, but to interact with the Logos. And at this level, Prometheus is born. So there is now a stealing by the desire life of Logos. A little intuition, the seeing how to do something. A little flash up of the desire energy and a bringing down into the desire level of a bit of logic. Quite deliberately. There is an awareness that if you are very logical, you can fulfill more desires than if you are not. So Prometheus personifies precisely this thing, the inbreak of logic into the desire life. And the desire changes its orientation. Previously, it has been horizontal like the body and the biofield. The desire has been reacting to a stimulus on the material plane level. But now it orientates, it turns round. It is now vertically orientated. It steals the PR, the pi ratio of the Logos, and brings it down into the desire field. Now the moment this happens, it means a peculiar thing, that the individual human being can fulfill his desires in his own way. Previously, he's been at the mercy of the gods, because the gods have only to arrange a special stimulus situation for a being at the desire level, and that being will move towards it or away from it. So the man who designs the stimulus actually controls the behavior. So, when Prometheus becomes aware that logic is a possibility, he steals a bit of logic. It's not yet his whole life. He just snatches a bit when he needs it and starts fulfilling desire in his own way. Now, he's called a benefactor to the human race by people who are very, very biased because his blessing has been very mixed. Actually, what happened historically, the moment that peculiar mutant occurred that we call the Promethean type man, there was from that moment a pursuit, an intelligent pursuit of techniques of fulfilling desire and getting away with it. To be able to fulfill one's desires by rational trickery and to get away with this fulfillment is Promethean. The result was that for a period of time, covering many, many centuries, human beings devoted themselves to the rational pursuit of sensual pleasures. We find a whole block in human history of rational pursuit of sensual delights. When you read about the Romans stuffing themselves with food until there was no room in them for more food, and putting their fingers down their throat to vomit it up, to start again. That's rationality. That's Prometheus. Now, it was a good thing. It was terribly clever. I love eating. Unfortunately, I open my mouth and already there is a peach in it, right up to the teeth. How can I put another in? Aha, says Prometheus. Pull that one out. Tickle the back of your throat, they'll all come out. So they had a special room called the vomitorium. I used to go and and then you could start again. But this was Promethean. This was deliberate exercise of logic for the investigation of sensuality to extreme degrees. Now, moralists might think that's a very bad thing, but in actual fact it has done the human race good, because most people have involved into them, as a result of that practice, a capacity for tickling the back of the tongue and vomiting, which is quite useful if you swallow poison. Everything is a mixed blessing. The Promethean activity has conferred upon us a capacity for vomiting. It's also given us a capacity for creating hiatus hernia, which is another aspect of the same thing. Now, when the Promethean self does this, above the level of this highly rationalized sensuality pursuit, the true logic is still there watching. And this true logic is this Zeus, this light, this consciousness. So it says, I see that we have no alternative now to deal with this fellow in any other way than tie him to a rock and let a vulture or an eagle or a cormorant, in Liverpool they're called live birds, come along and tear out his liver every day. Because if you behave like this in your eating habits, you won't do your liver any good. Now, to tie Prometheus to a rock is to turn his mind downwards into the physical world. The rock symbolizes materiality. So he's tied down to materiality. He will now, instead of turning upwards and getting more reason and more reason and usurping the throne of Zeus, of actually belonging to the gods, by means of his sensual experiences, he will be tied down progressively more and more and more into ever deeper pursuits of sensuality in the material world. So that in the myth, Prometheus is represented as tied to a rock, and the eagle or vulture comes and tears out his liver during the day and goes away, and at night he mends it again so it can come tomorrow and re-tear it out. What we have to observe is this, that rationality in the human race, dedicated to the pursuit of sensuality, has tied man down into the material world. As long as we pursue the sensuous, the pleasurable, and use our reason for that, we orientate downwards into the physical world, and therefore we cannot climb onto the next level. So Prometheus, who was considered to be a benefactor by men who wished to indulge themselves sensuously because he taught them how to do it, is also seen to be the man who tied human beings down into the material world, fixated them so they couldn't get up to the next level. It's a matter of pure logic. If we pursue sensuality with logicality, and we do this persistently, we condition the body so that the body itself becomes sensitive only to pleasure stimuli moving towards them and away from pain. So the whole psyche, the whole consciousness is orientated into the material world. It cannot further develop if that is so. Therefore, in this myth, it says that Zeus decided to wipe out this race of Prometheans because they couldn't evolve any further by their process of sensual self-indulgence and rationality. They had tied themselves into the material world. So instead of being orientated upwards to discover the will beyond the zone of pure logic, they had turned down into the investigation of the physical body. Therefore, Zeus, that is pure intelligence itself, ties this man down and is determined to destroy him. Now, you've probably read many of you Lao Tse's words, the people are straw dogs fit for sacrifice. Now, that is a very ancient judgment. When Lao Tse wrote that down in the 6th century BC, he wrote it down out of the imperial libraries, where it was one of the best books, many thousands of years older than he was, which said, there are beings who are vertical, they are bipeds, and they look like other beings, but they are not. They are body-bound, life-impulsed, and desire-orientated, and all their reasons are downwards. The Bible says their breath goeth down to the ground, even as the beast. They are orientated only downwards. Therefore, in practice, they are no better than an ox. And in the Bible, the word ox refers not merely to the thing that pulls the plough, but to any biped walking about, looking like a human being, but who is actually orientated downwards to the earth and to sensuality. So, those beings who are purely logical say, if these beings behave in this way, it is functionally legitimate to treat them as they are themselves functioning, because they have categorized themselves as beasts. They have said, I have no purpose in life but the fulfillment of my sensuous purposes in the physical body. They have made the definition, so say the gods, that is the enlightened, purely conscious human beings. Why should I disagree with his self-definition? Therefore, Zeus, pure consciousness, says, I will make me another race. I will destroy this race, progressively, in a series of wars. I will hope for plagues, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, anything whatever that will aid me to eliminate that block of beings who look like human beings but are not. They're not human beings because they have not understood this principle of power. They are men because they count, but they are not human because they are not power counting in their evaluation. So he says, I will destroy them. Now, because Zeus represents pure intelligence, and because levels of intelligence vary, and because some of the people historically have been behaving like beasts, and a few, an oligarchy here and there, have said, it is better for us to increase our intelligence, even at the expense of not pursuing those merely sensuous experiences. Because if we move upwards into the realm of pure logic and we obey that logic, then we ourselves will be sons of that God who is the will. Now, if we say that the will in the Christian Trinity is symbolized in the Father, then the Logos symbolizes the Son. And everything below that is symbolized in the manifest world. The Father, the Son, the operative activities of the Holy Ghost create the universe. When in the prologue of the Gospel of John it says, to those who believe about this principle, they will be given power to become sons of God. Everyone who believes that it is better to be self-determinant, to be free, and rather than to condition one's organism always to pursue the pleasure to the point of imposition of slavery in oneself to one's own biological processes. To make that choice and say, I will accept the logic of being, and instead of turning downwards, I'm going to go upwards. I'm going to do here what every great Messiah has said and what Christ said very clearly, I, the Son, am come to do the work of the Father. Your logic is to do the work of your will. It is to break the stimulus of desire, the responses of the periodic biofield, and the mechanicality of the body, the horizontal forces. And it is to turn around and become a physically vertical being. Now this is the story of Prometheus. Prometheus remains bound to that rock, and every day that vulture comes and tears his liver. For every being who is a biped, but who is orientated downwards into the physical world in the hope of increasing the pleasure experiences by utilizing the lower reason. But Prometheus becomes unbound. Shelley was very concerned with Prometheus unbound, to release this Promethean and say, yes, it was very useful to introduce reason into the desire field, but immediately there was a fall, because every time you get a new invention, you always get an abuse of it. As soon as that reason came in, it was converted to furthering the purposes of desire, and there was a fall. But at least it introduced reason into the desire, into the life field, into the body. So all we have to do is reverse the process. That is to say that we now have the reason in our desires, and we have a possibility of choosing. As to our physical body, we have mechanicality. If you trip over the carpet, you may fall down under the influence of gravity. That's your physicality. Periodically, the life force operates. You know, the sexual cycle is related to the cycle of energy from the sun. And so your biofield is periodic. It's not mechanical, like your physical body is. You hit yourself with a hammer on the knee, and you may cause a bruise, because you have made a physical damage, and then the life field has converted it to a bruise, because it is defending itself. And there is a periodic process, sexual excitation, periodic process, seeking for food, and so on. So there is mechanicality there, periodicity there, and in the desire level, subordination to the character of the external stimulus. And these are three horizontals. And a being that is merely a being of desire, life force, and physicality is like an animal. The being that gets little shafts of reason and then uses them to persist in animality is not like an animal, and is not like a human. He's a weird kind of being. He's a being with a higher power than the animal, who misuses that power. And this misuse makes him far worse than any animal. No animal can be as bad as a human being who is using all his reason to devise methods of increasing sensuality and sensitivity in the body to it, because it progressively binds consciousness into that physical level. Now, to be very realistic, not all men use it for that purpose, and those who don't rule the world. We know that the Roman patricians had a large party where the wine and the women flowed equally freely, a Saturnalia, and they then took their sons at puberty and they showed them their drunken servants wallowing about, and they said, "Do you wish to belong to those drunken, besotted, sensual beasts? Or would you rather belong to the oligarchy, to the government, to the few who are in control?" And the son had to choose. If he chose to go with the fathers, they gave him his toga virilis. If he did not, well then in the early days he was put to death, because he was useless, and he would only have been guilty of creating revolutionary tendencies in the others if he went over to their side. So the obvious thing to do, if he didn't see the need for belonging to those who have self-control, he was better dead. So we know historically there have been small groups of illuminated men who have not devoted themselves to conditioning their bodies to ever more and more dependence on the horizontal stimulus situation, but who have made themselves vertical so that the influx of intelligence increases more and more, so the desires become subordinate and the biofield periodicity is subordinate and the physical body behavior is subordinate to that pure logos. And that when they are so able to subordinate those three horizontal levels to this logos, then they are technically called sons of God. Because this pure reason is willed by that will which is called God the Father. So any person who says, I will operate pure reason, pure logos, and I will not be subordinate to horizontal stimuli, I will not be enslaved by desire or by my periodic biofield responses nor by the mechanicality of my body, I will not be so determined. The moment he says this, he is initiated into the order of Melchizedek, into the order of the sons of God. And because this will is eternal, then they shall not die, and they shall have no mother or father. This is the definition of the sons of Melchizedek. They have no mother or father on earth because they are self-generated by the will of the Absolute at that point. So that every such being is absolutely self-determined, no longer a slave to the trickery of the few who know how to provide a stimulus to the desire, who know the periodicity of the biological processes in the human race, who know the mechanicality of the body. You know that many, many millions of pounds are made by firms who know how to advertise. And the essence of all advertising and all propaganda is based on that trinity. People have a physical body which they'd like to dress up. They'd like also to have with it some other things, like motor cars and houses and so on. They also have periodicity, sexual responses and food responses in the biofield level, and they also have desires, some of them quite weird, some of them certainly not worth having, but they're there. The advertising copywriter knows this, and he continuously plays on physicality, periodicity and desire. But he never plays on your pure reason, because if he did that, he'd be out of business. If at the level of ordinary advertising there are men coming enough, then think there are men above the level of mere advertising. There are men who factually govern the world. In every country, there is a handful of men constituting a government. They make decisions and they know the rules. They know what desire is. They know what periodicity is in sexuality and food. And they know what mechanicality is in the physical body. And every pronouncement that they make is based on the careful examination of that trinity. Now, it's a very interesting thing here. If we think of a very ancient saying, the three went down to the four, and they took away from the four one and made four above, leaving only three below. Now, you remember how we changed. Oh, that's rather charming. I think we'll go the other way, shall we? More rationalists are skating by. The three went down into the four and stole one. Now, if we take our five, if you remember, physical body, life force, desire, reason, will. But the desire can be downwards towards sensual experience or upwards to freedom. So we have two desires, one vectored downwards towards sensual delights, one directed upwards to freedom. But also your logic is twofold. Logic vectored downwards to devise methods like a Japanese handbook of sexual technique of delights, and logic vectored upwards to freedom. Now that makes seven. So if we now say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and we observe this peculiar thing, the fourth one is the middle one, and the fourth one corresponds with this desire finger, which he split, so that we have a desire going downwards and a desire for freedom going upwards. Now, in ancient analysis, it was said very, very simply that the body function and the periodicity function and the desire function, whether vectored down or up, was feminine. So that number four meant femaleness, because it was divisible. Any even number was called female because you can divide it. The vulnerability of woman is her divisibility. Three, the symbol of which is a triangle, was considered to be indivisible because it was an odd number and it could close a zone, and also made an arrowhead. The three there were the will, the father principle, the pure analytical logic, and the upward vectoring of this same process. And these three constitute the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. And below that level, there were four. That is, your physical body, your sexual periodicity, and your desires, down and up. But by entering down one plane, the fourth was captured by the Trinity above. That is to say, thinking, feeling, and willing captured the desire and forced it to go upwards. And that left below a being with a physical body, periodic life force, and desires vectored downwards. But now they're entirely subordinate to the four above. So we could now draw a square for that four above, and we've drawn a Masonic symbol of the Temple of Solomon, the triangle on the square. Your threefold being that has captured the middle plane, the desire plane, vectored upwards to itself, so it is no longer subordinate to what is going on below. Now we see that the Promethean myth, analysed in a fivefold way, is quite simple. That if we say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then this level here, the third one, is the middle one, the desire. But it's cut into two, that is desire upwards and desire downwards. And it is this vectoring of the desire upwards towards freedom that determines the next stage in the evolution of the human race. There is going to be a new kind of human being, a human being that cannot be duped by the oligarchy, cannot be deceived by a handful of men who know the rules, because they themselves will know the rules, and therefore they will be undeceivable. In the Bible they're called the elect. And it says that the time will come, actually we're going into Aquarius, and this is the time referred to, when technicalities, trickery, magical games, computerization and mechanization will do such marvelous things that Raymond Baxter himself will be astonished to see them. And they will be so marvelous that they would deceive, if it were possible, even the elect. That the elect cannot be deceived because they themselves understand the meaning of that word. The El in Elect is God. The Ect means the control field. It means you recognize that only insofar as you inhibit yourself consciously when a stimulus comes and you analyze the stimulus in terms of your freedom, and you actually say to yourself, am I free in my response or am I conditioned? And in principle, if I am conditioned, I say no, because it's conditioning. And when you are able to do this, then you are of the elect. You are a God being, able to practice ECT on yourself. Now here we have the real meaning of Promethean introduction of rationality. From below, the physical body was organized by outside forces. The periodic sexual and appetitive life was organized by outside forces. The desire life is conditioned by the character of the stimulus, outside forces. And then at a certain moment of history, there was an inbreak from above into that of reason. And it was a temporary thing, and it appeared initially that this thing was going to be of great use to what was below. The desire world, the life world, the body world was now going to get its own way. And the intelligence to introduce that was Prometheus, forethinking. He could calculate the methods beforehand whereby he would guarantee great delights for himself. But in so doing, he conditioned himself into such a way that he was tied down into the physical world, nailed down so that he didn't know there was any other world. And he now spent all his time and all his reason devising new methods of pleasure and new methods of wriggling out of the consequences. So Prometheus was a very mixed blessing. And then a poet, Shelley, and other thinkers have said, why cannot we rescue this Promethean figure? It was a good effort. He stole fire, that was courageous. How about him now being intelligent enough to utilize the fire that he stole, so that instead of being bound by this rational principle of forethinking into greater dependence on desire, on life impulse and on physicality, that he shall use the same thing to study fully the real meaning of the Logos. And those who understood that have said, we can only do it by fighting against physical inertias, periodicity, reaction to stimuli from outside. If you find it extremely difficult to get out of bed in the morning when you're very tired, you can understand what physicality means. If you find that you promise yourself to do something or refrain from doing something to do with sex or food, and you find that in actual fact you have been defeated by it, you know that the biofield is still ruling you. If you find that an external stimulus can please you and make you move along towards the object, and a painful stimulus can keep you away from the object, again, you are enslaved, and all your reasoning is only the lower Prometheus. But if you wish to help that Prometheus to get up, you have to say, at some point, I am going to become purely logical. Don't let's be afraid of this pure logic. Remember the diagram we've done? There is a Greek L. There is a Greek gamma. That is a Greek O. That is another O. And that is an S. We have written the word logos as a diagram instead of as a serial word. If I wrote it that way, that's linear, logos. If I write it that way, it's a diagram, it's the same word. That's the origin of it, and this is derivative. And it means, let there be light, that's the lambda, that's pure consciousness. Let there be gamma, the physical body, certainly is a reference point. Let there be a reason within, and let there be a reason without. Because you have to have your pure reason on the inside for debating with yourself. But you have to remember Christ's warning, I send you forth as sheep amongst wolves. You need an external reason for dealing with the other people, especially the Prometheans of the lower order. And there will be an issue. There is your serpent coming out, your subtlety. You are a being of pure consciousness. You are a being of physicality. You are a being with a deep inner reason. And you are a being with an external relating reason for dealing with other people. And out of this total situation are the issues of life. So the logos is not dry logic of the Aristotelian kind. The logos is the life principle. Pure consciousness, pure physicality, pure innermost reason, and pure adaptability to the external world, because there are lower Prometheans in it, and the issuant statement from this total simultaneous complex. All these together, considered simultaneously, are logos. Anything less than all those together simultaneously is not logos. It is an apology for it. So let's salute Prometheus for doing one thing. At some very critical point in the past, many thousands of years ago, there had been already prepared a physical body. It had been sensitized so that it became a life protoplasm. It had been vectored by the stimulus to be desire, towards and away from. But at a certain critical moment, reason flashed into it. And it might have lifted it up, but it didn't. For a long period of time, there was a solid block extending over generation after generation of dedication, of reason, to ever more and more subtle modes of self-titillation. When you think of the great Sardanapalus and others in the ancient world who were so busy enjoying themselves that another nation could declare war on them and walk in while they were still in bed. And they were so drunk and besotted, when they were given the news, they would say, open the gates, I'm busy. This is a historical fact, that the Promethean dedication of the lower reason to the pursuit of sensuous delights actually caused the overthrow of many, many empires. So if we do not wish to be overthrown within the individual empire, within our skin, we have to say to that lower Prometheus, it's time to turn up. No longer be horizontal, be vertical.